What can the G7 do to stop the war in Ukraine? Leaders of the world's biggest economies say that they're imposing more sanctions on Moscow, but is that enough? And can the group remain united against Vladimir Putin? This is Inside Story. Hello, welcome to the programme. I'm Adrian Finnegan. 4 months of war in Ukraine have exposed deep divisions in the global order. But the fighting is also highlighting and testing some of the oldest and strongest alliances. The G7, a group of the world's seven largest economies, is meeting this week in Germany. Sanctions by some of its members and counter-sanctions from Russia have disrupted everything they've touched, from oil prices to supply chains to the price of bread on the other side of the world. Under Germany's presidency, the G7 is pushing for solutions to reduce the impact of the war on the global economy. Well, G7 leaders issued a statement to remove any doubt about their commitment to Kyiv, saying that they will continue to provide financial, humanitarian, military and diplomatic support and stand with Ukraine for as long as it takes. They also announced targeted sanctions on those responsible for war crimes or exercising illegitimate authority in Ukraine. The statement added that Russia bears enormous responsibility for rising threats to global food security as a result of the conflict. China is also on the G7 summit agenda. $600 billion have been pledged to counter Beijing's Belt and Road Initiative, and Beijing has been quick to respond.
China welcomes all initiatives that promote global infrastructure. We believe that there is not any initiative aimed at replacing each other. What we oppose is to advance geopolitical calculations and smear the Belt and Road Initiative in the name of promoting global infrastructure development.
So let's bring in our guests for today's discussion. From Berlin, we're joined by Ulrich Bruckner, who's professor of political science at Stanford University in Berlin. From Washington, D.C., Doug Bando, senior fellow at the Cato Institute. And from Oslo, Glenn Diesen, professor of international relations at the University of Southeast Norway. Gentlemen, welcome to the programme. Ulrich, let's start with you. So G7 leaders will stand with Ukraine for as long as it takes. As long as what takes? What is it that G7 leaders want, and how long is long?
Well, all these questions have not been answered yet. What we saw was a strong signal, and that's the symbolism of summits of that kind that sometimes feel a bit like 20th century, as if we are not having phone calls or Zoom meetings. So it's more like we send a signal, but we don't go into detail, because everyone is affected differently from the sanctions, and everyone also has a different agenda or is more or less careful with all the balances that need to be considered.
Doug, what do you make of it? How long is long, and what is it that G7 leaders actually want here?
I don't think they even know. Clearly, perspectives differ in the different capitals. Countries are affected differently. They have different past relations with Russia. They have a different, I think, willingness to tolerate cost. In terms of where we're going, everyone would like to see Russia to lose, but that doesn't necessarily mean a victory for Ukraine. And in many ways, I think that is the biggest issue. Is the emphasis going to be on trying to reach some kind of a ceasefire and peace, or is the emphasis to help Ukraine have some kind of a military victory? On that, we don't know. And those outcomes are very different and have a very different implication for the cost and the length of time.
Glenn, victory for Ukraine, humiliation for Russia. What is it the G7 leaders are after?
Well, that's kind of unclear, because when you talk about victory for Ukraine, what does this mean? Because at times Ukraine has expressed this interest in reconquering all of Donbas, even taking back Crimea. So this would entail an actual war with Russia. And again, part of the Russian motivation behind this is obviously to stop the NATO expansionism and this increasing amount of American weapon system close to its border. So if Russia would pull out, obviously these weapons would only keep pouring in. So I'm not sure how that victory would be even possible. I think Russia would fight this definitely all the way to the end. So I just don't see clearly how victory has been conceptualized here. Also, it's unclear how even a stalemate is going to result in any kind of a diplomatic solution, because again, the fear from Moscow then would be obviously that the West would take advantage of a temporary peace agreement to merely rearm Ukraine and keep pushing NATO. So it's a lot of big statements, but without any clear operationalization of this, a clear objective, what this would actually mean.
All right, so Ulrich, they put on this united front, as you say. They made this strong statement of support for Ukraine. But what is actually going on behind closed doors, do you think? How long can their unity last, given the economic consequences of the war?
Well, that's what I meant by the different balances that need to be considered. And in my humble understanding of what has been the motivation or the objectives, because I clearly don't understand how Putin ticks, there was a calculation that the West is post-heroic, not willing to fight a war, not taking a risk. We don't believe in anything. We are nihilist. We are secular. And so as wimps as we are, it would be easy to go in and to achieve objectives that made no sense in terminology like a denazification or whatever kind. So what we have now is a united West, a much stronger NATO, an even extended NATO, a stronger investment in rapid intervention forces. So basically the opposite of what Putin tried to achieve. But we also have a situation in which all the different leaders face different domestic pressure. Some struggle more with inflation, some are more dependent on energy import, and some are weaker than others when we look at the internal discussion about what is a fair price to pay for expressing solidarity, or what can a leader push through. If we look, for example, at Macron, his position was way stronger before the parliamentary elections a few days ago, and this is all something that needs to be taken into consideration.
Doug, who's leading the G7 right now? Okay, Chancellor Scholz is hosting this meeting, but who's in the driving seat as far as policy is concerned? Is the US at the moment taking a back seat and following the rest, or is it actually leading, do you think, at least in terms of the war in Ukraine?
Well, in terms of the war, I think the US, broadly speaking, has driven the process. The US has contributed substantially more in terms of money and weapons. It has the advantage of having the real military, that dominates NATO. Frankly, the country that most European countries have cheerfully cheap-ridden on for decades. So there's an element of which the U.S. has a natural leadership role there. But, it's not alone. The other countries matter, and it matters a lot to have other European countries indicate they are prepared to do more. And we see even a country like Turkey can throw a spanner in the works over the issue of bringing in Finland and Sweden for its own purposes. So there's leadership, but there's not domination. I think that what we see going forward, as indicated, Macron has his own domestic issues. Certainly Germany, a complicated political situation, a three-party government bearing significant energy costs. Even in the U.S., the politics is not going to be easy. Outside of kind of Washington, support for a deep commitment to Ukraine is not necessarily that strong. I talk to my non-political friends, and they are asking why $40 billion when that's a lot more than Europe has done? Why $40 billion when we have a $1 trillion deficit? And we see in the Republican Party increasing willingness on the hard right to ask questions about this. So this is going to be a very difficult process going forward. Nothing is guaranteed.
Glenn, the European Union, while represented at this summit, doesn't, the G7 itself doesn't represent all European nations. How does the rest of Europe, minus the UK, France and Italy, view the war in Ukraine?
Well, I guess Europe is very split in many ways. The Western European countries are more cautious while the countries like Poland and the Baltic states, they're more hawkish, more aligned with the United States and the UK on this matter. So I would say that initially, I think we've had a lot of unity because of this invasion by Russia took everyone by surprise and the shock, which was why you have this common interest in balancing this common adversary. But I do believe that a lot of this unity was based on the premise that NATO would have a victory over Russia or Ukraine supported by NATO. But I think what you will see is not just a split between the US and European, but within Europe as well, you will see more of these divisions displaying themselves now that the conflict is not going our way. Because again, Russia's winning now on the battlefield and the sanctions have backfired terribly on the Europeans. So it becomes therefore very reasonable to have more divisions within the G7. For example, I've made the argument that the US and the UK would probably like to see this war going for a while because it has many good objectives for the US. So it imposes bloc discipline within the West, which the US has not been previously able to achieve. The US has been able to get the Europeans to decouple from Russian energy and economy, which they didn't do in the past. We also see that the US can now extend this European divorce to China. So Ukraine will be a bulwark against Russia for the foreseeable future. And the US has this opportunity of making Ukraine and Afghanistan for the Russians to bleed dry its economy and its military. So it has many opportunities for the US. But that's what I mean, there's a split, because for the Europeans, there's a much higher cost and incentive, therefore, to push an end to this war, because simply because they're paying a higher price. They don't want an Afghanistan on their continent. Their weapon storage have been depleted from all these transfers to Ukraine. The sanctions are hurting the Europeans much more, not just this temporary energy crisis and high inflation, but we'll also see that European industries will no longer be competitive on international markets, as all of this cheap Russian energy and metals are now exported to Asia. So the production cost will therefore increase dramatically in Europe. And overall, the Europeans become more and more dependent on the US as a result. So all these EU goals of strategic autonomy will now collapse. So I think you will see more push now from, for example, the Germans, the Italians, and the French to have some more diplomacy to sit down with the Russians. And you saw this on display now with these three leaders from Italy, Germany, and France going to Kyiv, asking to start negotiations with Russia. Meanwhile, you know, thereafter, you have Johnson coming from the UK saying this is not the right time for peace, and the Americans sending heavier weapons. So I think that this, as the conflict continues to go the wrong way for us, I think these divisions within the West is going to just become more and more obvious.
Ulrich, how long before the European electorate begins to demand that their governments ease the sanctions and pull back on this war? Are people in Europe prepared to endure a winter of power cuts or rationed energy supplies, do you think? Will it come to that?
Well, if things continue like this, there is no other way than to restrict not only industry, but also heating, or have other means that clearly show that we are part of this war, not as a party of war, but we are massively affected, far more than the United States. But it's very difficult to predict because we don't have this one European electorate. We have very different conditions in each and every member state, and we also have different communication techniques by the more or less popular leaders that also play a role until there is something like a change of power within European Union member states. At this point, of course, German politicians would love to see a diplomatic solution for this, but public opinion is still very strongly in support for actions of solidarity towards Ukraine. And Olaf Scholz or Emmanuel Macron at this point in time don't really have much to fear.
Doug, I just want to give you an opportunity to respond to what Glenn was saying about the US perhaps liking to keep this war going for the moment. And then I want to ask you, would the G20, do you think, be as solid in its support for Ukraine and condemnation of Russia as the G7 is?
Well, the broader you go, the less support you find for the US-European position. Of the top 10 population countries in the world, only one is taking this position, America. You know, very notably, not only China, but India have resisted. Indian purchases of Russian oil have skyrocketed very dramatically. But you go beyond that. You look at Brazil, you look at South Africa, you look at Indonesia. I mean, these are countries that have not jumped on the sanctions bandwagon. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, the global South is much more cynical about European and American pretensions and morality. I mean, the U.S. believes in a rule-based order, except when it doesn't, and then it invades countries and occupies them, even if it's against international law and it kills a lot of people. The President Biden is talking about human rights and about to make a trip to Saudi Arabia to beg the Saudis, who've killed hundreds of thousands of people in Yemen, to provide more oil so the U.S. can sanction Russia. I mean, the problem is those kinds of inconsistencies really play out in other countries whose view is much more cynical. They don't like the aggression. I mean, Russia's clearly in the wrong, but they're also much more skeptical of following leadership that they frankly aren't quite so happy about. And the potential of Indonesia inviting Russia to the G20 meeting, adds quite a complication. Exactly how that would play out if it happens, I think, would be difficult for everyone involved.
Glenn, while the G7 understandably sees the war in Ukraine as critical to global security, what about the rest of the world? How supportive of the G7's position are Asian, African, Latin American countries? To what extent do many countries, while sympathetic towards Ukraine, simply have to put their own citizens first?
Well, that it kind of shows with the numbers who's joined in on these sanctions. And, well, it's pretty much restricted to NATO. The rest of the world hasn't really joined in on any of these sanctions. But I would agree with Doug. It doesn't mean that they support the Russian invasion of Ukraine. By no means. I think most countries would condemn this. However, while there seems to be some consensus around condemning it, there's not that much interest in punishing it. Yes, correctly, because there's not that many see this moral authority of the West, and also they see more dubious interests behind this in terms of knocking out the key adversary as opposed to standing up for democracy as it was. But it's also more recognition around the world that even though this is war, it's Russia's fault for invading, that NATO obviously provoked this to a great extent. I mean, this is, you hear this around the world, and not just sometimes inside NATO as well, with Turkey now saying the same thing. You even heard the same from the Pope. So there seems to be a large consensus that NATO provoked this, but then that Russia shouldn't necessarily have invaded for that reason. But you also, of course, have this economic interest behind it. So it's for the Europeans, for example, to dictate to the Indians that they shouldn't buy any Russian oil or gas. It seems very, very provocative, especially as the West buys Russian oil and gas. But overall, I think they will look after their own interests. And one also have to see these huge opportunities for Asia now, because European economies have been very competitive because we've had access to all this cheap Russian energy and metals. And now Russia is, as they're diverting their entire economy towards the East, and they're preparing themselves for a permanent divorce with Europe, the Asian countries will become much more competitive, as Russia is offering even discounts to Asia for their oil and gas. So I think they will look after their own interests and not get involved in what is effectively a European conflict, a 30-year-old proxy war between NATO and Russia, which has now spilled in and begun to destroy Ukraine.
Ulrich, has the G7 signaled clearly enough that it understands the gravity of the global commodity price crisis and other economic shocks linked to the war, and that they will take realistic steps to address them?
Well, the question is, what would realistic steps be? And what has been said before, that repeating the Russian myth of NATO is threatening Russia, doesn't make it any more credible. NATO has no appetite to be involved in a military conflict with the second largest nuclear arsenal in the world. That makes no sense. What threatened Russia was the economic prosperity west of Russia. If we compare Ukraine and Poland, then Poland became 4 times richer by joining the European Union. And if the anti-Ukraine would do the same thing, that would undermine the credibility of an authoritarian regime in Moscow. So if the West would give in and say, well, actually, we didn't expect it to be so expensive, and it also has externalities on the rest of the world. We stopped the sanctions. What would be the situation on the ground? We could possibly find something like a frozen conflict, but then both sides would try as much as they can to strike back and to win the upper hand. That is not the end of the conflict. There is no military solution in this conflict, and it needs more than giving in of the one or the other side. This would only, in my understanding, be a solution if other heavyweights like China would step in and do their contribution to stop it.
Doug, the G7 statement said that the group will foster coordinated initiatives that promote global food security. To what extent should that, along with the rising price of fuel and commodities, be their number one priority, at least in terms of maintaining support for the war in the rest of the world?
Well, there are obvious humanitarian reasons to do it. Set the war aside. You know, the lack of exports, particularly from Ukraine in terms of grain, are posing an extraordinary hardship on poor countries that are least able to deal with it. The problem is, again, it's not clear exactly what the West can do. That, you know, there have been proposals to try to forcibly open, you know, ports of Ukraine in the Black Sea. That would require, number one, cooperation from Turkey, which is not at all, in my mind, likely. But second, that would be itself a potential casus belli. And I think what we have to recognize here, the danger of this is the longer it goes on, the more dangerous I think it gets, which is, you know, for Russia, this is a vital interest. For Russia, this is an existential interest. We don't have to think it should be, but it is, in my opinion. It's not for the West. So I think that Russia and Putin are quite willing to risk and spend a lot more. And along the way, Ukraine is the primary victim. I mean, the World Bank figures the economy will be cut roughly in half. Millions of people have fled the country. Cities are being reduced to ruin. So the longer we go, the more dangerous it could spread, the more the Russian... I mean, the danger of a question of a new use of nuclear weapons is one most people assume won't happen. Nevertheless, to the extent they fear a loss, I think it becomes more dangerous. So there's so much at stake, and certainly the issue of food is huge, but I don't know how we solve that absent ending the war. That is, unless one is willing to forcibly try to open the Black Sea and get the grain out, the question is, otherwise, are we, as the West, prepared to share its resources, to accept higher food prices at a time of raging inflation? I don't think the Biden administration would, for all of its humanitarian rhetoric. The Democrats face a potential disaster in November by-elections to kind of raise prices further, to appear to be giving away American product. And I think Europe faces the same difficulty. With energy prices rising at home, what can it do in terms of trying to ease the food shortages abroad?
Glenn, I've got less than a minute here. Just a quick answer, please. Bearing in mind what Doug was saying there about Russia being pushed into a corner, are the sanctions against Russia working? Are they having the desired effect?
Well, they're having some effect. So far, of course, the West's main goal was to destroy the Russian economy, financial system, and the ruble. Well, so far, we see that the economy is stabilized, the financial system stabilized, and the ruble is much stronger than it was before the war. However, a lot of this punishment or the pain of sanctions will probably come later on. So I think the worst of the sanctions is yet to come for Russia. But that being said, the point of sanctions is to change the political behavior. And I don't see Russia changing its policies, because for Russia, this is deemed to be an existential threat. NATO expansion towards its border, it's said for more than 20 years, is an existential threat. So they're not going to give up because of some economic problems. So they will probably continue to fight this to the end. And exacerbating the conflict. So it depends how we define the effectiveness of sanctions.
Okay. All right, gentlemen, we're out of time. Many thanks indeed for being with us today. Ulrich Bruckner, Doug Bando and Glenn Deason. And thank you for watching. Don't forget you can see the programme again at any time by going to the website at aljazeera.com. For further discussion, join us at our Facebook page. You'll find that at facebook.com/AJInsideStory. And you can join the conversation on Twitter, our handle at AJInsideStory. From me, Adrian Finnegan, and the team here in Doha, thanks for watching. I'll see you again. Bye for now.